All right, you're now tuned in to the Follow Through with Clips and Drew, the True Players Podcast, episode 277. We are so confused with the Celtics. What is going on in that series? D. Cooker and the Phoenix Suns tie it up 2-2 heading back to Denver. Drew has the Lakers winning tonight and heading back to the Bay 3-1. Should Russell Westbrook and Pat Beverly get championship rings? We don't know. It's the Follow Through with Clips and Drew. Drew, kick that intro music. What up, podcast world?
What's up, everybody?
You know what it is. You know where you're at. It's the Follow Through with Clips and Drew, the True Players Podcast, episode 277. We had two game fours last night. We have two game fours tonight. We have a lot to go over. I want to start with the two series that I have absolutely no idea what's going on, and that is Boston and Philly, and then we got the Knicks and the Heat, Drew. Let's start with the Knicks and the Heat. I'm so confused with what the hell the Knicks are doing. Does Julius Randle want to show up and play? They can't hit a three-pointer. We're at this point in the playoffs and with Miami where it's basically like Jimmy Butler's just going to will them to another series victory with a bunch of G League guys that are just showing up to play. The Knicks are getting outplayed. Again, they can't shoot a three. I don't know what Julius Randle's doing. Like, are the Heat really going to beat the Knicks and just break the heart of Knicks fans everywhere? What's going on, Drew?
Yeah, it kind of feels like that. It's not surprising to anyone to hear that Jimmy Butler is the best player in this series. And sometimes it's just as simple as that when it comes to playoff matchups, where you're Jalen Brunson's doing his best to keep pace with Jimmy Butler, but Jimmy is just, you know, shining through here, even though he didn't play in game two, which was, the only win for the Knicks in this series thus far. And look, the game three was a pretty spectacular blowout. 86 points only for the Knicks, mm-hmm. 105 for the Heat. And Jimmy, you know, really just picks up where he left off. You know, we thought maybe that ankle injury would be hampering him a lot more than it was. I mean, shooting was a little off, I guess. It was 9 of 21 in that game three. But that's still, 43%. And he had 28 points in this game and was the leading scorer from both sides. So this is one of those things where You brought up a very important name, and somebody I thought this series would really lean on for the Knicks in Julius Randle, who, in game three had 14 rebounds, but only 10 points, and continues to have some struggles shooting the basketball. So who knows, when it comes to injuries and things like that, who knows how healthy or not Julius Randle is. We know that Jimmy's been able to play through his injury, Jalen Brunson able to play through his. But perhaps this is something that's a deeper issue when it comes to his ankle problem, because it has been a nagging injury for several weeks now, stemming back all the way to the beginning of the playoffs just before the regular season ended. So as far as the confusion goes, though, Clips, I'm right there with you, man. This series is so strange, but it's just as simple as I think the Heat might just be the better team here. At the very least, they have the best star on the floor.
Yeah, it's obvious. And then there's this body language with Russell that's with Randle, that's just screaming, I don't want to be here, right? And you're in this position. You're supposed to be the leader on that team. I don't see it. Even that game, I think he was 4 for – what was he that game? He was 4 for 15, 0 for 5 threes. One thing you and I hate the most is Julius Randle taking threes, and he still absolutely loves doing it. It's got to drive Knicks fans crazy. But it's just a shocker to me that we're going to see most likely. I mean, again, every time we call something, it's pretty much wrong. I thought Phoenix was dead in the water, and now we're looking at 2-2 going back to Denver. We're going to talk about them in a minute. But I just can't call this series. I really can't. No. And if it's going to take a Herculean effort from Jalen Brunson to beat these guys, but I think it just seems like the Miami team, when you're led by a guy like Jimmy Butler, it seems like the rest of the team starts to take on that personality, that dog, and they all seem to be doing it. They got nothing to lose. They got Cody Zeller out there, like looking like a beast. You know, that guy wasn't on a team for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So I just think the Knicks are getting outplayed. They're definitely getting outshot. And in order for this to work for the Knicks, Julius has to be the man there. But from everything that I'm seeing, it's not looking like it. It looks like Hartenstein wants to be out there playing. You know, he's out there hooping and they're trying their best, but I don't know, man. I'm not really feeling that series. I can't call it, and I honestly don't care. Do you care about this series? Nah,
look, I mean, we're definitely West Coast biased here. Right. I mean, that would be a way for all of our listeners, I'm assuming, understand that we like the West Coast ball a little bit more. We talk a lot about it, as our teams are in Los Angeles. But look, you know, I do feel like this is kind of the perfect storm for Miami. Once you get over the hump of the Milwaukee Bucks, everyone's got to be feeling pretty confident after that on that team. Max Strus is playing quite well. Mm-hmm. Gabe Vincent really like solidifying the fact that he is a NBA level starter. And, you know, shout out to Spoelstra for recognizing that and pulling Lowry off the bench now. And Lowry's even doing quite well in that bench role, coming in and scoring a little bit, doing a little bit of everything. The flopping, of course, continues from Lowry.
Of course.
As it will always. And the Zeller piece, I think, is interesting, too. Like, again, going back to, like, the matchup aspect, Cody Zeller can't play in a lot of series, right? Like, in the Bucks series, tough for him to be on the court. But in this series, they have Mitchell Robinson and Hartenstein. He can definitely be down there banging bodies because he doesn't have to be exposed on the defensive end to try and guard anybody. He just needs to stand his ground, be the big body in the middle, and try to rebound in the minutes that he's playing alongside Bam or in replacement of Bam Adebayo, who is also having a very good series in his own right. But, you know, I don't think Julius needs to be the man, something that you mentioned. He definitely needs to be the second, though. Like, Jalen Brunson can still be the best player for the Knicks. But, you know, with Julius, he needs to consistently deliver the performance that he was able to do in game two, which was like a nice 25-12, right? I think he even had like 8 assists in that game. That probably gave the Knicks fans and the Knicks team, you know, a big boost of confidence because he wasn't able to play in game one. So, but they're definitely in game three, the body language thing from him happened. I just think they were frustrated in a loss like that, and which can happen because nobody was really hitting any shots. So we'll see how it goes tonight. I expect the Knicks to continue to play really hard, and defense is never really the issue. Playing hard tends to not be the issue for that team. It's like, can you put the ball in the basket now? And you know, when you're playing 100 miles an hour, those legs can go for you pretty fast. And we're seeing that potentially result in missed three-pointers. But also, truthfully, when Jalen Brunson's not making threes, he's their best three-point shooter. When he's not making threes, that's a real big problem, right? Like in game one, he was 0-for-7 from three. And he's had some decent performances in this series. But I just want to go back to the fact that the Miami Heat in general are a great matchup for this Knicks team, right? Like they're not going to back down. They're going to play really hard defensively. And I'm with you though. It's hard to call. I mean, look, the Heat have been better, so I'll lean that way. And I'll stick with the fact that Jimmy's going to remain the best player on the court in this entire series. I don't see that changing. Perhaps Brunson can go crazy in one night, or even Julius can go crazy in one night and steal that little, you know, best player on the floor crown for a moment, but it won't last very long. Jimmy is clearly the best player on this court, even so, coming off of an ankle injury. So the Heat, I think, will advance, and then they're gonna you know, bring it fully to whoever the fuck can get out of this weird Boston Philly series, which does feel a bit like neither of them want to advance to the next round.
It's so weird. Let's go into that, because the roller coaster, I don't know who's a bigger roller coaster. It's either Harden or Anthony Davis. I don't understand. Game one, Harden, vintage Houston Harden, who puts up a huge game. And then games two and three. Three looked like he had signs of being like first-year Markelle Fultz with the yips, like couldn't even take the shot, didn't want to take the shot.
It was right back to the end of last year. It was a flashback to the end of last year's playoffs for him, and then bookended by two incredible performances, which is so weird.
It's crazy, and I do think that Embiid came back a game too early, possibly two games too early. It does look to me that he's laboring a bit, even though he put up good numbers the other night. But the Harden piece is, it's so wild, dude, how he can look like he shouldn't be playing in the NBA in one game, and then the next game just turn it on like that. and hit the game winner and do what they got to do. I'm more confused at what Boston's doing offensively, defensively. You know, if I'm looking at the team in front of me, Philly, I'm looking at a hobbled Embiid. I'm looking at a Harden that does not play defense. I'm looking at a 40-year-old PJ Tucker who's playing 40 minutes a game. And I don't understand why these guys aren't running these dudes down the court. Like, remember that game, the game that Embiid was out and they were just giving it to him in the paint, constantly pushing the ball, transition, all that. And they're not doing that. And these weird at the end game or at the end of the quarter shots that are being drawn up, the no timeouts. Why is Marcus Smart taking 10 three-pointers in a game? Why is that happening? You know, and I think we can blame it on a rookie coach all we want, but at some point, and where is Jaylen Brown too? Why are they not running any plays for Jaylen Brown in these times? They're settling for these dumbass, long distance three pointers at the end, even at the end of that game where Marcus Smart just threw it away off of Jason Tatum. Those plays are not going to win you games. And I go up and down with Boston. Like, at one point in the season, we're like, it's them and Milwaukee. Like, hands down, those are the two best teams in the NBA. And this seems to happen a lot with these guys that they tight buttholes, man. I just don't understand what they're doing. They're so confusing to me. And do you agree with me that you think Embiid came back a little too early? Do you think he should have sat a couple more games, or because he won that MVP trophy, he felt like he had to be out there?
I think both of those things are correct. I think he got the MVP trophy and was like, all right, cool. Like, let me go out there. We have a chance to go up 2-0 and then bring that 2-0 lead to Philly and let's close out the series. And I think everyone got really excited after they were able to steal game one behind a crazy performance from James Harden. And they were like, let's just take this momentum and build on it. It's easy now to look back and go, he definitely shouldn't have played that game because it wasn't even fucking close.
Right.
In game two, it was all Boston. So it looks like a really dumb decision. But when we recorded the last podcast, I thought for sure he was going to sit out game two, have him be on the court for game three. And, you know, if you lose game two again, you know, you're still up 1-1, you stole one, you're in a good spot to bring it home to Philly and take care of business there. The counter to that, of course, is that, like, you know, he probably needs to run, right? He needs to run. He needs to get the game shape. You don't want to lose him. You know, he was out for 2 weeks or whatever. You don't want to have him completely lose pace with the NBA game. So you get him in, maybe you do a minutes restriction. I think Doc Rivers called it like an eye test instead of like a minutes restriction for game two. But the truth of the matter is he definitely should not have played game two. Get him on a bike, get him running on a treadmill, get him running in the pool, get him doing other calisthenics and things like that to get his lungs ready. But don't bring him back with a giant fucking knee brace in game two and then lose game two in a spectacular fashion the way that they did. But yeah, man, this one is also very, like we're talking about the series, this one's just as up and down as any other. I mean, I'm so confused by this series and by the Nuggets and Suns series. There's more evidence in the Nuggets and Suns. When we talk about it, we'll get there. But for this one, to me, it's so strange the way that these teams are playing. Now, the first thing I'll mention, even after saying that, is that both teams are playing really hard, right? So there's not like a lack of effort coming from either side. Now, you can point to James Harden and go, well, there's some lack of effort there. I don't think there's lack of effort. I think there was just lack of like confidence. Somehow he went from the top of the mountain all the way to the bottom of the valley, just like a lightning bolt. Once Embiid won, I think Harden was like, cool, like maybe I can take a breather. Maybe that's what he was thinking. He's like, all right, maybe I can take a relax a little bit. But then he went on like the worst shooting streak that I've seen out of him. He was like in game two and three, he was like 3 of 26 or something like that in those games. It was insane. And then to come back again in game four and then refine everything and drop another crazy game. There's not really a way for us to quantify what the difference was there for James Harden and why he decided to be more aggressive. And you know, that's only James Harden will be able to answer that question. And I don't even know if he'll have a grip on what the fuck just happened to him coming, you know, looking at the four different games that he just played. It's so strange. But yeah, definitely they should have rested Embiid because I think he could have used that extra couple days.
Do you think Doc wants to send James Harden to Vegas for a minute on the day off? Like, just go back to Vegas and do whatever you got to do?
Clips, I said that on this podcast. I said, I mean, after game one, I said Atlantic City's not far from Boston. I know
that's
there's
not Vegas, though, bro.
No, but it's as close as you can get. It's as close as you can get up there. And I mean, shit, New York City's not that far, man. If you want to go that route, there's great strip clubs in New York City over Atlantic City. Although I haven't attended any in Atlantic City, I'm sure that there's a few that are probably quite nice establishments. But you know, it's a joke, but it's not really a joke. There must be something about him that needs some sort of release, but I who knows, man.
Well, some people like strip clubs. Steph Curry likes to play golf before these games, like Michael used to do sometimes. If that's his release, it is what it is. It just needs to be closer to home. You know, you don't want your star.
Vegas ain't that close. That's
it's not that close. It's a PJ hop for sure. I'm just like it, on the Boston side, even that final play. Look, Harden was great. Harden was great in game one and game four. If you look at his numbers from the previous game, 16-23, and he was all over the place. 8 boards, 9 assists, 4 steals. Yes. Like, the guy was active and amazing, right? And I'm just confused on that final play too. I'm confused at the 10 three-pointers by Marcus Smart. I'm also confused at, in that final play, you know, the last thing you want is a Harden three, a Harden look at any kind of three. And he got it. Jaylen Brown comes off of the Harden to double Embiid, which I don't think you needed to do at that point, because a 2 takes you to OT, 3 wins the fucking game. What do you think the call was? He wasn't wide open. Jaylen Brown got back and did contest, so it was a good contest. But leaving Harden open in the corner for 3 should have been called out in the huddle, saying we cannot let this happen.
Well, and especially when you have PJ Tucker on the floor. Like, if PJ Tucker is on the floor, you help off of him. You do. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward piece of coaching that should be, you know, very, very easy for all of the Boston Celtics players to identify. Am I the guy guarding PJ? Okay, then I am the guy that's going to go help. We're not leaving Maxey and we're not leaving Harden, right? Tobias, fine. If you're the guy that has to help and you leave Tobias, okay, then so be it. Or Niang or whoever it is. But if PJ Tucker is on the floor.
I like him too, by the way.
Who?
Niang. I like him for whatever. He might make my all underrated team. The guys I want on my team.
He's a solid player, cerebral player. Mm-hmm. Was a kind of a do-it-all guy in college for Iowa State. At his size, his game had to shift in the NBA because he's not athletically as dominant and physical as he was able to be at the college level. But he put in great effort and shifts in Utah before coming over to Philly. I think he provides exactly what they needed off the bench, and is a stout defender as well. Like, he's not great because
he's not a punk either.
His athleticism limits his abilities a little bit, right, on both ends of the floor. But he, like I said, he's smart. He's cerebral. He knows how to play the game. He knows how to pass and move and all the good stuff that you would want out of a bench player. But look, PJ Tucker needs to be the one. It's happened twice now in these games. Don't let James Harden go one-on-one against Al Horford. Don't let James Harden catch the ball wide open and then have to have a contest, a late contest, to close out on these kind of final plays. That's really bad. And I don't know, you know, in the moment, maybe this is Joe Mazz, Bazooka Joe, the head coach of the Celtics, telling him these things, and then they're not implementing them. They're just not doing it. Jaylen Brown just like kind of lost it. Where I don't, again, going back to what you said about him, I don't know where his head is at right now as well. It feels like he's kind of one foot in, one foot out at times in these games. So maybe that was just a lapse in his mental capacity for that moment. And he's just like, well, Embiid's got it. I have to go run and help because he's the guy that's going to shoot it. But it has to be said by Joe Mazz. And if it's not, then that's a glaring, glaring issue from a coach. We assume that it's being said that you leave PJ and you don't leave Harden. But then it's just not being done on the court. So I'll take a little something here from you, because watching Joe Mazz, I don't know if you've been catching up with Succession, the show Succession. Do you like that show?
I do, but I'm not all the way up like I'm supposed to be.
Okay, I'm caught up fully, and you've watched all the seasons prior. So this relates to, it's not something you need to be watching like this last episode in order to get this. But I got a lot of big Kendall Roy energy from Joe Mazzulla, if you know what I'm saying.
I do.
It's like he thinks he's ready for this moment. He wants to be ready for this moment. He thinks he's doing all the right things, saying the right things in the preparations, but there's a disconnect in some points from like what his version of what the reality is from what is actually happening, what's playing out. And that's showing up in these moments defensively. And then the lack of offense was confirmed by Marcus Smart after, I think it was after game 2, where Marcus Smart was asked a question about the offense, and he goes, "The offense is just kind of random," I think was the quote, where it just kind of there isn't an offensive scheme. And that just can't be the case. You're in the freaking playoffs.
It can't be the case if you're trying to win a championship at all.
Yeah, and not only that, you have two all-stars and two like all NBA caliber offensive talents in Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And if there's not an offensive scheme to get them the ball in the right spots, then they're not going to get out of the series. And they're not going to, even if they do, they won't beat the fucking Miami Heat. They won't win a championship for sure, because whoever's coming out of the West is going to bring it as well. I think it's the first thing that I wrote down after watching them. I think it was watching game three. I'm like, it feels a bit like Kendall Roy. I did also, of course, watch Succession recently after that. But anyway, that was a note that I made there, where I do think he really could have used some support from the coaching staff, right? Like in terms of potentially getting an assistant coach with a little bit more of experience and maybe even helping specifically, like getting either a defensive coach so he can go, cool, that assistant can really help and direct the defense, and I can focus on the offense, or getting an offensive minded coach so that he can focus more on one of the two facets of the games. You know, a lot of the coaches, I mean, Bill Simmons even brought this up on one of his most recent podcasts, but like Steve Kerr had Ron Adams up there, who was like a defensive juggernaut, and Alvin Gentry, who's kind of like an offensive guy and an out of bounds guy that's kind of a master of those things, to help guide the team, because it can't just be the head coach. And look, Phil Jackson, one of the most successful, if not the most successful head coaches ever, always relied on his assistants to provide different value points and different viewpoints. Tex Winner, of course, the architect of the triangle offense. And he had defensive minded coaches alongside him all the time to try and help scheme for things, because it shouldn't just fall on Joe Mazza's shoulders. It shouldn't just fall on Steve Kerr and Phil Jackson's shoulders. That's why you have a coaching staff.
That's why you have 12 coaches on the bench. Exactly. 12 of them. What are they getting paid for? Are they just shagging balls in practice or what?
Now, yeah, and let's be fair, right? The coaching staff got pillaged, right? Mm-hmm. Will Hardy's over in Utah, and Ime is obviously going to be in Houston, and so maybe there's something about that they just couldn't react and respond quick enough, or there was a lack of talented assistant coaches that they could go to. But it feels like it's showing up right now, because the Celtics team is very, very good, as we've known the whole season, and it rightfully we had them up there with the Bucks as the best team in the NBA, because that's what they were proven to everybody. But there has to be a scheme when things slow down in the playoffs, as they do, because the intensity raises the levels of everyone. Shit slows down in these offenses, and they're not getting in transition. So if they're refusing to get out in transition, you have to have an offensive mindset in the half court. And at least one thing that they can go to and go, okay, this is the thing that will run. If you're not going to implement, 10 different plays, that's fine. But let them know that there's one thing that they can come back to where they go, okay, let's run, whatever, elbow up or whatever the fuck play it is that they know they can go and get a bucket from.
Yeah, you can't, when the playoffs slow down, you can't have a confusing offense where it's random. It just doesn't work like that. It just seems like a lot of ISO ball for Jason Tatum. Seems like he dribbles does his little shimmy, his fadeaway, gets his jumper off, and like that's the whole offense. That can't be. There's some really good plays that they run for Horford, to get that 3-point shot, which I like a lot. But when it comes down to it, going into game, what do we got? Game five coming up for them. Going into these final games, I want to see Tatum and Brown take over. They need to be the guys. They need to put up big numbers. Look, Embiid's going to get his, man. That's what's going to happen. And Harden can either shoot his way into a great game or shoot his way out of a game really easily. I don't know how to call this. Another series I just don't know how to call, because I don't trust what Boston's doing. I don't. And I don't trust Doc either. So I'm not too sure.
And it's impossible to trust Harden, right? Yes. Like this one really, like I will lean on the Heat. I'll go out. I'll say the Heat will win the series that we just talked about between the Knicks and Miami. But in this one really does feel like a coin flip, because it's so dependent upon James Harden and his ability to like feel confident enough to take the shots that are important for him to take, even if he's missing them. You can see, especially in game three, when he's not taking the shots, everything falls apart. Even if he's missing the shots, it's like, okay, well, you missed it, but let's, you know, it just leads into more good things happening, right? Because at least you're still keeping the defense honest when you're taking the shots you need to take. And yes, sometimes you can do a pump fake and then move it on if it's just not your night, but it can't be one of those things where you're driving to the lane and you're looking around like you're fucking Ben Simmons out there who doesn't want to look at the goddamn rim. So that can't happen. And I'm with you though. This one does feel confusing. We just talked a lot about like the Celtics deficiencies, you know, and we praised Harden for his good stuff. It's obvious when he's on that the Sixers are a better team. They're obviously a lot better when you go from whatever, like 9 points to 40 points. There's a big, big difference. Joel Embiid is actually something I want to talk about though, because even though he is still a little banged up, it's pretty obvious that the Celtics don't have much. And I do want to shout out Grant Williams though, because he's putting his body, Horford as well, but Grant Williams especially is really, really putting his body on the line.
Yeah, he put his whole mouth on the line. He got stepped on by
Embiid. But he's doing like the dirty work that when Embiid is tired makes it much harder for him to find good positions. So I'm watching these games and I'm going, why is Embiid still catching the ball, you know, 16, 17 feet away from the basket? That's because number one, he's tired because of the knee injury. And number two, Grant Williams is just leaning on him. He's just pushing him out every second that he doesn't get the ball on his hands. And that's really paying off for the Celtics defensively. And it's forcing the Sixers into like all of these different things that they're not used to having happen when Embiid is constantly catching the ball so far away from the basket. And with tired legs, as we talked about, jump shots will fall short. So when Embiid's shooting 16 footers, that's a win for the Celtics defensively. Even if he makes it, that is a win because you just want to keep him away from the paint. So if he's going to be continuing to be happy to take these mid-range and long-range jumpers, then I think the Celtics will win this fucking series because it's those margins, man, especially in a series as weird and as close as this is, that can't happen. So I want to talk just for a brief moment about the Sixers' deficiencies offensively. And that is, it's actually kind of similar. They don't get out in transition at all unless it's Maxey doing something. And then when they're in the offensive sets, they don't really run an offensive set either. But they can lean on the Joel Embiid pick and roll as their go-to, which is something the Celtics have yet. Right. Well, for sure. But the Celtics still don't even have like, okay, at least we know the pick and roll is coming, right? They don't even have that. The Sixers have that, but then it becomes way too easy for them to defend, because there's PJ Tucker in the corner who can't do anything. And you know, I'll be fair to him. He did hit some big shots in the last one. And of course, he made a you know very impressive layup, offensive rebound layup.
Huge,
towards
big,
the end.
Big shot.
Yeah, and I think he's still valuable to the team for what he brings to them defensively and leadership-wise. I think he's a valuable piece of the team. But it does make the Sixers a lot easier to defend when you have PJ in the corner who – you know, as we talked about in game one, didn't even take a shot, didn't take a free throw. So that whole thing to me also needs to work itself out. And I don't expect it to offensively for the Sixers. Doc Rivers is not going to magically implement some sort of motion offense now. But to me, it's a lot of Harden and too much dribbling. And then when he has to get bailed out, then it's like a scramble for someone to just chuck up a shot. Because Joel's getting pushed out and then double teamed every time he touches the ball. So it's not been easy. And I want to commend the Celtics defensive pressure for making that as difficult as it can be. But the truth of the matter is here, Clips, and this is where I'll close with the series. If Joel Embiid can really just put his foot down, use his weight against Grant Williams and not get pushed out, just refuse to get pushed out, or do the Vlade Divac and stand your ground, and then when Williams pushes you in the back to hold his ground, fall the fuck over and get Grant Williams out of the game on fouls and get to the free throw line on fouls. He has to do one or both of those things for the Sixers to have success. They can't rely on James Harden dropping 40 points and winning this series for them, because it's seen that he can't do that consistently.
Yeah, and if history repeats itself, he's going to have a horrible game five, right? Yep. That's what's going to happen, and we'll see what happens with that. I agree with you, man. I think the only way Boston's really going to flip this series is defensively on Embiid. He's so good at passing out of the double team, though. It's just getting those people to hit down those open threes. You know, he doesn't do well when he forces, when he's double teamed. He doesn't do well like that. But passing out of the double team, whether it's Maxey or Toby or James Harden, they got to knock down those threes.
And they can. That's the thing. Is like, as long as he's not finding PJ, again, Celtics need to like let PJ be the guy.
Yeah.
Let PJ shoot 10 threes. Let go ahead. Like, let see what happens if you make him shoot 10 threes. But I'll go back to one other thing that I mentioned a couple podcasts ago when we were talking about the I think it was in the first round. Something I mentioned was Joel accepts double teams too easily. He is too slow, right? Mm-hmm. So first, he's getting pushed out a little bit. Second, he knows the double team is coming. So I think he goes, all right, I'll just catch it. I'll wait for the double team, and then I'll try and drop a dime. That can be cool, and that's nice to get everyone else involved. But the moments where he can catch and go and beat the double team, like beat the second guy coming and try and get his head down, go to the basket – that has to happen a lot more for him.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Tired and injured.
Yeah, right? I don't think that's going to happen this series with the knee. I don't see that happening. And they need Boston needs to capitalize on that, is basically what you're saying.
Yep.
And then just see what they could do about Harden. That's just all. That's what it's going to take. Let's move forward to can we both agree that Devin Booker's the best player in the playoffs right now? Can we say he's the best player in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think Jimmy would have a problem with that if he wasn't injured. Like if his knee or if the ankle didn't happen, I think Jimmy would go, actually, I think it's me, but I'm with you. I am in agreement. Devin Booker has been consistently the most outstanding player in the playoffs, without a doubt.
This has been incredible. And I've been waiting for like that one game where Devin Booker's it's just an off night. You know, it's not falling tonight. Devin Booker and Kevin Durant last night, 36 and 36. The clip that this guy is shooting at, right? He had 36 last night on 18 shots. He only had 6 free throw attempts. He made 14 of 18 from the field with 11 jumpers, right? This guy has just been buckets left and right. It seems like, you know, this is his time to shine. It's very, you know, he's from that group of Mamba mentality cats. He's from that group of Jason Tatum and Devin Booker, these guys that really looked up to Kobe and try to live by everything that Kobe taught and taught them. And it just seems like Devin Booker's figuring it out. He's matured a lot. You know, I'm not the biggest Devin Booker fan, but it's hard to be a basketball fan and not appreciate what this guy is doing. And we had mentioned on the past show, our last show, Denver was up 2-0, right? Yep. Denver was up 2-0. We didn't know if we knew CP was going to be out from 3 games or whatever. We had asked like, hey, what's up with T Ross? What's up with TJ Warren? What's up with campaign? What's up with Jacques Landell? What's up with these guys? And it just seems like I was telling you before the show, it seems like with CP out, they're playing at a much faster pace with campaign pushing the ball. I think there's some interesting things going on with DeAndre Ayton that we'll talk about in a minute, but I do want to focus on Devin Cooker, and that's what I've been calling him. He is the cooker. It's really impressive, man. And you know, when you have Jokic put up 53 and 11, and it's this duel last night was something so special. You got KD hitting shots everywhere. You got Jokic just with the unsexiest moves of all time, but just being productive on everything. We'll talk about the Matt Ishbia thing in a second. And then, you know, you have my guy, Wham Bam Thank You Sham, who out of, you know, the depths of the bench, the NBA bench, Shamit comes out and knocks down. What do you have? Five three-pointers? He had 5 last night, 5 for 8. And
Huge fourth quarter.
And I'm not shocked by it. Look, I like Landry Shamit. I had him for three seasons with the Clippers. I saw him hit big shots, right? Mm-hmm. In the playoffs. I saw him at Oracle basically win the game for us in Oracle. Now, yes, that was a long time ago, and Landry Shamit has, you know, exchanged hands with a few different NBA teams, but that's what he's there to do. He's not there to be a defensive stopper. He's not there to create his own shot. He's there to knock down three-pointers when he's open. And he can hit him with a hand in his face too. But we can talk about Wham Bam Thank You Sham in a minute. The focus here is on Devin Booker and exactly what he's doing. And I'm waiting for this game where he just doesn't show up and he's not there. He looks completely locked in. He looks like every single shot he's taking is a good shot. They're not rushed shots to me. Like you can see with Jason Tatum sometimes, there's a lot of dribble, you know, touch somebody, fadeaway shot, bailout shot. Every shot I see Devin Booker taking, is a good shot. He's been extremely aggressive going to the rim. He's good with the back to the basket. He knows the bread and butter is in the mid-range game. Some people, a lot of offensive, great offensive players nowadays like to shy away from the mid-range and go straight to the three because that's what everybody's shooting. Look at Kawhi Leonard, look at DeMar DeRozan, look at CJ McCollum, look at, you know, Devin Booker, what he's doing right now, and KD as well. But what I'm seeing from Devin Booker is something super special. And what we're doing with this series is now the series is clear. It's best to, you got to win two out of three now. Michael Malone was very adamant, was saying, look, it's a series now. It's we didn't do it. They didn't do anything in Denver. We didn't do anything in Phoenix. Now we're coming back home. We got to win at home. I think there's a couple things that were interesting to me. And you know, man, I have Michael Porter Jr. stock. I do. I have stock on him. But then he does some dumbass shit that just, you know, that transition three that he took, as soon as he took it last night, I was like, what the hell are you doing? And if I'm Michael Malone, if I'm Jokic, I'm sure Jokic said something to him that guy. Mm-hmm. I get where Michael Porter Jr. was going with it. He loves to shoot transition threes. But where's the self-awareness? Where's the awareness of you got the center trailing right behind you? You got to know what this moment entails. And I think they had numbers going into that. You're 6'10", man. Take it to the rack, get fouled. Why are we forcing a three? So let's start with D-Book, Drew. What are you seeing from Devin? What are you seeing from the adjustments that Monty has made that are working for him? And I do want you to talk about Jock Landale too. Before we talk about the issues that we have with DeAndre Ayton, but these are the guys, these are the pieces that are needed to win these games. What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, Booker is fearless, right? And I think the thing that surprised me, probably surprised a few other folks, is how much there is a pecking order here that Kevin Durant seems to be comfortable being the two of, right? Devin Booker in the pecking order is number one. And that has shown out through these entirety of these playoffs, where I thought it was going to be Kevin Durant being like, hey, you know, give me the ball and we can kind of do a 1A, 1B thing. And to a certain extent, they're still definitely 1A, 1B, and Durant is fantastic. But what I am seeing is that Booker is running everything. Right. And then KD's getting his looks as needed. And I think everyone's playing pretty good on the Suns, at least in these last three games, you know, it's certainly the last two at home. But the freedom with which they're willing to let Devin Booker operate, including Kevin Durant, is surprising to me. What is not surprising, though, is how well he's excelling at being the point guard, essentially, and dribbling the ball up, because he had to do that for so many years before they got Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. And so this shouldn't be a shock to anybody. And the second thing is, you know, when it comes to playing more guys, that being Terrence Ross and TJ Warren, especially those two guys, Shamet as well, but especially those two guys, like you said, we asked for Monty Williams to release the handcuffs on these guys and say, like, why did you bring them in here if you're not going to put them in now when you need some fucking minutes and you need some fucking scoring? That's what those two guys can do. And look, those two guys in particular, Ross and Warren, haven't like lit it up, right? But just by them being on the court, there's the threat of them lighting it up. Both guys have had tremendous scoring runs in the past. I double checked it, Clips. You asked me if Terrence Ross had a 50 piece. I double checked. He had 51 against your Clippers.
That's what it was. I knew I remembered it from somewhere. I knew it.
And so any man in the NBA who has dropped a 50 piece, the list is a lot longer now than it was, you know, 5 years ago, but any man who's dropped 50 points in an NBA game has to be respected, has to be treated as a threat on the floor. And while they haven't lit it up, they've also hit some pretty big shots. TJ Warren in that fourth quarter had some really big buckets for them, and they weren't the prettiest, but they went in the basket. Mm-hmm. And so this is the interesting thing about this whole thing is I think a lot of people will look at, oh, Chris Paul is out and the Suns are playing better, and they're going to correlate those two things. I don't think it really actually matters, because if Monty Williams used these guys the way that he could have with Chris Paul on the floor, I expect them to play the similar way. Give guys fucking breathers, especially your 38-year-old point guard. Happy birthday, Chris Paul. He just had a birthday, so he's 38 years old now. But like, I think had Monty Williams unlocked these guys in game one and game two, they could have had a much different look to him, especially again going back to the fact that they're dealing with altitude in Denver as well. So it's not only are they old and they have a lot of minutes collectively on their bodies, specifically Chris Paul and Kevin Durant, But you're dealing with the elements as well, man. And like, just let the boys run for 15 minutes and see what happens. And because, you know, if you're going to lose the game, so what? But at least you're building confidence within the entirety of the squad so that if Chris Paul goes down in an injury like he did, they're ready to go. But it's worked out really well for Monty Williams in games 3 and 4. In game 3, nobody else scored 10 points. So as much as I want to praise the fact that these guys are playing, it has been entirely Devin Booker and Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm. So the bigger piece
is here, that sustainable too? Like, do you think
it is?
Right. It can be.
It is because they don't have an answer for them defensively. Denver does not. So right. Devin Booker is Devin Cooker. He's cooking up chicken nuggets right now because the Denver Nuggets are chicken nuggets when it comes to defense and guarding him. And we saw, I think it was at the end of game 4 last night, where Jokic was just yelling at his team and saying that there's just two guys. Mm-hmm. And that's really Shamet really stepped up in the fourth quarter. He did. And I think, you know, TJ Warren, maybe the TJ Warren buckets I'm referring to might have been in game 3 when I was talking about that earlier. But it is definitely those two guys. And the only reason I think it's sustainable is because they've yet to run into any sort of defensive pressure that's causing them any issues. And
the 40 minutes a game is going to be rough, though. That's going to catch up at some time, right?
Yes, it will. And I'm more nervous about Kevin Durant in those 40 minutes than I am Devin Booker, who's still 27, 28. 26. I think Book has no problems. He can do it. He'll be fine. He can just run 40 minutes a night and he's in his prime. So that's fine. KD, I'm nervous about, right? Like that's, you know, that has to be in the back of the mind of Monty Williams. And even in the back of the mind of Kevin Durant himself, when he's running out there and he's like, fuck, I'm winded right now.
And he's playing defense too, man. Defensively, he's playing hard defense. Great.
He's contesting shots. He's falling on the ground as he's playing. He's hustling. So I think what I had called out as like a throttling of his effort level in this first round series against the Clippers is no longer happening for Kevin Durant. He is playing 100% in this series. But I have to assume that Monty will be monitoring the minutes here moving forward. But at the same time, you know, they can't lose this series. They should be looking at this series as we should advance here. Because when you look out on the court, yes, Jamal Murray can pop off and do some things, but they have two of the best three players in the series. Nikola Jokic is arguably the best player, you know, at times on the floor. I would say Devin Booker has been the best thus far in this series, but 1A and 1B there, Jokic and Booker, and then Kevin Durant, of course, is 1C if you want. But then there's a pretty steep drop off from that, where Jamal Murray might be the fourth best player on the series, and that kind of goes in and out. But that actually brings me to like the larger point that I have a problem with Denver about defensively. Jamal Murray is trying. I think at times he's trying really hard, but he's just not a very good defensive player. He doesn't have the defensive instincts. He's an offensive first guy. That's what's got him into the NBA. That's what got him to Kentucky. He can score, right? But that actually is also causing a problem for Denver. Murray is trying to do too much offensively. And I understand they need him to do a lot. And the Suns are making it somewhat difficult for Murray to do that. I think Shamet actually put in a pretty decent defensive shift on Murray.
He can.
He's long enough. He really can't stick with him, but nobody really can. Jamal's a very, very talented scorer. But I watch time and time again him dribble the shit out of that basketball and not pass the ball at times at all. Like he'll just take a whole possession where he's just dribbling around and then he'll fire a shot that's contested, a fadeaway. Mm-hmm. He might even have two on him and he's firing that up. And when you have a world-class two-time MVP on your team, you shouldn't be having to force up fadeaway shots against contests against two or one individual. Like let's run some shit here, right? Like let's get the ball to our big and then we'll run some actions off of him. Nikola Jokic has to touch the ball every time down the floor. And there's too many times where he does not touch the ball in this Denver Nuggets last two games. And that's shocking to me. So the momentum has to be all with the Suns, you know, right now after those two games. And I think the tide has turned here. I was, you really? Know, in the last podcast, I thought the Denver Nuggets were going to win in 5. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I would have bet $100 on the Nuggets winning in 5. I think the tables have turned. I think the Suns have figured this shit out a little bit. And if they can get Chris Paul back, I sincerely hope they don't drop the rotations down to the whatever it was before he got injured. Like, let's keep the flow going here. If CP can be back for game five or game six, whatever it is, let's have him be out there, but let's keep these rotations moving. Campaign is certainly helping them get out in transition. Booker, of course, running the point, also helping them get really good looks and get out in transition. I think I would pick the Suns here to take this series now.
It's easy to say because they just won two in a row at home, though, right? So yeah, they're going back to Denver.
No, but this is my point, is not that they, not simply that they just won two in a row, the way in which they're now using their whole team.
I don't think Shamit's going to have 5 3-pointers in the next game, okay?
No. Like, I don't think so either. But defensively, both of these teams are lacking defensively, right? And when you have all your horses running, I am going to lean on the fact that Devin Booker and Kevin Durant can outscore Jokic and Jamal Murray, right? Yes. So defensively, we have problems on both ends here. But now that they can actually get, you know, a couple minutes of rest here and there as needed and provide, you know, other players on the court other than just like the 6-man, 7-man rotation that they were running with, that's what I'm saying is, like, I think this is going to be kind of a shootout of a series. And I think they got the better shooters in that analogy.
Yeah, Denver needs the others to step up. Michael Porter Jr. and Aaron Gordon, and definitely Jamal Murray needs to be Jamal Murray, right? They do need big buckets from him. The KCP, who had a couple really good games. I'm more interested in what's going on with DeAndre Ayton and what's, like you mentioned, Chris Paul. I think Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton play really well together. Like, Paul is great for DeAndre Ayton, and then when Paul's not there, he kind of gets left on an island a little bit, and we saw him get benched in game three, and then we saw Jock Landale get a lot of minutes. And the reason why Jock got these minutes is because he's putting a body on Joker. And we saw, like, in game one, there was that one play where DeAndre Ayton was just, like, standing under the rim watching Joker get four rebounds in a row, and Jock wants to come in there and play, and you need those guys. And I thought I'd get through one podcast without bringing up the Clippers, but, like, you know, you need the Mason Plumleys, the guys that are really out there that are different defensively and actually put in that extra effort. I remember at the beginning of the year when I was doing my Clippers show, Phoenix destroyed us, right? And Jock Landale had a humongous game, like, murdered us. And I said he looked like Kevin Garnett out there, like, literally just put us to shame. So the guy's capable of doing it, but the DeAndre Ayton piece, it just seems to me that, like, Monty doesn't like him. It seems like the players don't like him. There was in round one, there was a moment when he was at the free throw line, one of the Clippers was at the free throw line, and Booker and him were just getting in this heated ass exchange under the rim, like, during the free throw. And I'm like, damn, I don't think they like DeAndre Ayton. And then, you know, getting benched and Monty making those comments, and he could be so nice at times, that little 15 footer he's got down pat. But I think you can't really teach toughness, right? Like, maybe DeAndre Ayton is who he is. Maybe he's not going to be that profound shot blocker. Maybe he's not going to be that guy that really wants to put a body on you and be physical. Maybe he's not that guy, but I do think he's a very important piece for these guys to win a championship. He really is. I don't think Jock Landale is that guy. Now, at moments, at spurts, he might be the perfect guy for that. But what do you think about the whole DeAndre Ayton thing right now?
Yeah, this feels like this has been building up for some time now. Right, we've had that whole weird contract thing with him that happened, where it looked like they were just going to let him go, and then they decided to match the offer. What was it, Indiana, that threw out the big offer? I don't really understand what's happening there. Right, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in their team practices and in their meetings with the coach, like pregame. And of course, post game, because not only is it pretty evident on the court, we're getting shots of you know, camera shots of Ayton complaining to the assistant coaches of, like, why am I not in the game? I think there was one particular play where I think it was Jamal Murray went up for a layup and, like, got a foul and one, and then it flashed to DeAndre Ayton on the sideline, and I was able to see him say, I'm blocking that if I'm in the game. He said that out loud to an assistant coach, where I'm blocking that shit if I'm in the game. So there is definitely something happening there, and like I said, this is not just like a random out of nowhere thing. I think this is going back to, like, his original days as a Phoenix Sun, And this thing actually might be the Chris Paul effect, where, you know, in the great run that they had, they made it to the finals and they lose to the Bucks. There was, you know, a lot of reporting on Ayton's relationship with Chris Paul and how he's like being a mentor, but also being quite hard on him in the way that we know historically Chris Paul can be on younger players.
Anybody.
Not even just younger players, but literally any of his teammates. Ask Blake Griffin, ask DeAndre Jordan. And so we kind of like, we were like, cool, DeAndre's doing really well with that. And I even think he was like, yeah, this is fine. This is part of like the learning curve of me being a younger player in the NBA, learning from a veteran, and look what we did together. Like, Chris Paul is teaching me things. He's teaching me hard, but I'm still here. I'm doing my thing, and I'm producing on the court. And I think he actually had a pretty good finals. Like, you know, in my memory, I think he did pretty good in the finals against the Bucks. But like, I think maybe internally for him, as a man who's never had to deal with this kind of scrutiny in his entire life, 7-footer. I mean, he got, you know, the years leading up to him being in the NBA, he was the guy, right? No one was ever coming down on him like that. In my head, he might have thought that this will come to an end after that finals run. Or maybe, you know, I've done enough here to prove myself and I won't be like treated like a rookie for forever. And my guess is that he's probably a little tired of that treatment. And then this is where I don't know what's happening, is like, how is he in practice? Mm-hmm. How is he interacting with his teammates? What is he doing off the court? Does he want to be there anymore? Like, was the fact that you know, the contract negotiations took it all the way down to the wire for him to stay there, and like seemingly the Suns feeling comfortable with letting him go, did that just like turn something off in his brain and go like, well, you know what? Fuck this team. Like, fuck all these guys. They don't think I'm a part of this, you know, this run. They don't think that, they think that they can do this without me. And the funny part of it is for him, funny part, you know, I say that in jest, but the funny part about it is they're actually kind of doing it without him in these last couple games. Like, Landell is forcing him off the court because he's willing to do the dirty work that DeAndre Ayton doesn't seem to do. Again, it could be a blessing and a curse type of a thing, where you're gifted with athleticism, you're gifted with this height and this natural ability, where you don't necessarily learn how to block out because you never needed to. Jock Landell knows how to fucking rebound and block out.
And DeAndre, that's what they need. That's really DeAndre what they Ayton, need.
I don't remember him blocking out ever, like ever. You know what I'm saying? And look, you could look around the NBA, and Anthony Davis, I think, is guilty of this at times too. He doesn't block out, right? Why? I'm the biggest guy on the court. I can jump the highest. I have the longest reach. I'll go get the rebounds. These guys, I think sometimes, you know, it's little things like that. But when you watch Landell, or like fucking PJ Tucker's a perfect, to bring it all the way back to PJ, that dude blocks out from the 3-point line.
There's a reason why he's playing 40 minutes a game, right?
And those are the reasons. So I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, Ayton not willing to do like the physical, he's not willing to get physical for some reason, even though he's this, you know, really kind of stout, strong guy, is befuddling. I don't understand it.
And that's how you get benched, though. I think Monty is within all his power, okay with benching him if you're not doing what you need to be doing. And when you're getting out played by the backup center, by the third backup center, basically, because Biombo was supposed to be that guy too. But sometimes you need, you know, I think it's tough for Ayton too, because when CP's playing, do you think he's the fourth option? Like, he's the fourth option on that team, if not the third or fourth. And DeAndre, for whatever reason, thinks that he should be that number one option. And now with the current structure of the team, with Booker, the way he's playing, with Kevin Durant, like, his focus should be more on rebounding, boxing out. He can get a lot of points if he does that, right? Yeah. But he is so nice from that 15 foot, that 8 foot. He is so nice with that. I just don't know, man. I think writing's on the wall that this guy might want to get out of there if this doesn't go the way Phoenix wants it to go.
Definitely. I mean, look, wherever the season ends, I mean, look, championship, you know, maybe that changes things if they, they pull off a crazy championship, maybe he refocuses or whatever, but anything short of that, I wouldn't be shocked if he's not on the Phoenix Suns next year. But if he just took like a small page from the Looney manifesto, the Kevon Looney manifesto, and just said, let me see if I can get 20 rebounds tonight.
Right.
Let me see if I can get 20 rebounds. And I don't care how many points I have. I don't care how many shots I get. I think that would go a really long way for Monty Williams and the entirety of the team. and trusting him and to be out there and to do his best. I mean, look, it's so strange though, because as we've talked about in years past, even in the last couple of weeks, we can remember when Jokic said DeAndre Ayton is one of the hardest players for him to go against.
So weird.
And it's a weird thing. It's weird. I mean, and Jokic hasn't had to go up against Anthony Davis too many times. But my guess is that will also be a tough one for Jokic, because AD is you know, a little bit better version of DeAndre Ayton, if you will, or a lot better, I would say. Depends on the night, obviously. But for that to be a sentiment that Jokic feels, I would be surprised if he said that in jest, right? I do think that Jokic means what he says. He doesn't mince his words with the press. He kind of just hits his moments. He says what he says, and then he moves on, right? He doesn't fuck around. So I do think that there's an interesting development there. And I certainly think the Suns can get out of this series without DeAndre Ayton being, you know, the guy that we all have seen from him in the past, or even like a slightly better version of what he's been in this series, because Landale is doing the dirty work, because Landale is being the Kevon Looney for the team and just going, I don't give a shit. I'm going to rebound. I'm going to play defense. I'm going to foul. I'm going to dive for balls. And that's really what this Denver Phoenix, what this Phoenix Suns team needs from the center position. Especially when it doesn't matter who's guarding Jokic. Jokic is going to score 30, 40, 50, whatever he wants to score. You just need to make it hard for him to rebound the ball on the defensive end. You need to make it hard for him to make those fun little passes that he likes to make by applying ball pressure at as far up as you possibly can and getting down into the defensive stance and not letting it, you know, be a walk in the park for the big man.
So we can't just talk about Devin Booker and Kevin Durant, how great they've been, and not bring up that this dude did drop 53 points, right? 20 of 30 shooting. It was just like a shootout last night. But he would come down and he was doing it every single way. That little floater he's got, he was doing everything within his power to get them a victory. Shamit's the one that kind of put the nail in the coffin for them in that game. But 53 points. And you know what's funny, man, is like every single Joker game, he's got so many battle wounds on his body. Like, it just looks like
all the scratches.
Yeah. It looks like he, like, just 12 alley cats jump Joker in the locker room and just cut him to shreds. Like, this guy is unbelievable watching him play. It's really fun to watch him, but I want to bring up the Ishbia thing quick, 'cause that was pretty crazy. I really thought up until they just announced that Joker got a $25,000 fine for it, I really thought that they were going to have to suspend him. I thought it was going to be a one-game suspension, because all I was thinking about, and whether you like it or not, I'm going to say it, like, I thought if they didn't suspend him, that it was going to be like the race card pulled really quick by a lot of people being like, well, Draymond got suspended, or, you know, Dylan Brooks got suspended, and this guy in the rule books, it says you should get a one-game suspension. I honestly think Joker should get a one-game suspension. I don't want it to be a suspension for him. I don't. But if you, I don't think Joker knows who Matt Ishbia is. I don't think he gives two shits who Matt Ishbia is. I don't think he knows him personally. I thought he thought it was a fan. And I think with what he was saying was true. Those guys were touching him and around him, but I don't
know. And holding the ball. You can't hold the basketball.
You can't hold the ball.
As a fan, you can't hold that ball like hostage. It's not your ball.
And you also shouldn't be running into the stands trying to take the ball, Joker. Like, there's these little things that could have gone differently. I thought Ishbia flopped. I thought he did a great Marcus Smart, Kyle Lowry impression.
Michigan State, baby. He played for Michigan State. He knows how to flop.
Oh, he's had to flop. He probably made a career off flopping. It was just, we've never seen anything like that before. And they did, out of all the people, you can't kick out the owner. You know what I mean? They kicked out the one guy who put his hands on Joker. But here, I don't think Joker knew who Ishbia was, but I 1,000% know that he saw him in his rear view and definitely threw an elbow at him. He knew what he was doing. The flop made it even better. I thought Ishbia coming out with the tweet saying, look, I don't think he should be suspended. I want to see a game, which I think was awesome. But we've never seen anything like that before, ever. Did you think Joker was going to get suspended or no?
No, I was really hoping he wasn't going to get suspended. And I'm glad that the NBA is going to let this actually be the series that it should be and not take the best player from the Nuggets off the floor in a crucial game 5. I'm very, very happy with the results.
Do you think it's fair, though? Like, do you think it's fair? Do you think if that was Draymond Green, if the roles were reversed, if that was Pat Beverly, Russell Westbrook, if the roles are reversed, what's happening? I don't think it's a 25K fine. And maybe this goes back to the history stuff, right? Because the only real thing that we have with Joker, I mean, he's gotten physical with people, but is that Markieff Morris incident? That's the only time we've really seen him want to fuck somebody up, right? So anyways,
yeah, in the playoffs a couple years ago, the Suns and Nuggets faced off against each other. Maybe that, I don't know if it was last year or 2 years ago, but he does get frustrated by this Phoenix Suns team in the past. And he's gotten physical. I remember there was an altercation where he walked up to Devin Booker and the Jokic brothers got involved. You remember that? So look, this all stems from Jokic being entirely frustrated by what is happening in the series, at least in the last two games, in games three and four, he's like looking around. He's going, I can't guard Kevin Durant. I can't guard Devin Booker. Somebody please foul the shit out of I don't know what to do. He's just frustrated, right? It's like a natural thing. And I remember, you know, there's years for big guys, especially, right? Like you just talked about the beating that he takes every game. He gets walloped every game. And because he's a big boy, because he's a big boy, he can take it, right? And just like with Shaq, just like with Joel Embiid, just like with any of these guys, there's going to be one thing that flips the switch and they go, it's not funny anymore. I'm not taking this. And for Jokic, I think sometimes that boils over. And in this moment, I think it was one of those particular instances. I also think he's probably a little frustrated with himself. He was throwing some passes away a little bit errant in that game that are not typical of him. He had six turnovers in game four. So I just think it was one of those things where he was like, man, I think he knew how important that game was. If they could steal that game and then go home 3-1, you're just like, okay, we can see it. The finish line is here. We're going to get past this team. We're going to go to the Western Conference Finals. And then he could see it kind of slipping out of his hands, out of his grasp. And he did something that he shouldn't have done with the elbow. And I, to be honest, I think if Ishbia doesn't flop so flagrantly flop, like, oh my God, like, give him the Oscar right now. I think the NBA might've looked at it differently, but Ishbia fully, like he did the Derek Fisher, he did the Manu Ginobili, whatever you want to call it. It was right out of the textbook of any defensive player that's taken a flop in the last 20 years of the NBA. And I don't think it was malicious. I think it was one of those things where he's just like, get off me. Like, just get off.
Yeah,
me.
I think it was that.
Let me get the ball. Let's get back to the game.
But if we're – look, I always bring this up. Doesn't matter who the player is. If the rules are to get suspended, though, if you touch a fan, then you should get suspended. The question is, do you think it would have been a different outcome if it was one of those other guys that have a history of, you know, not necessarily a history of – you know, jumping into the stands or anything like that. But what do you think happens if that's Draymond? Seriously.
Well, I mean, look, Draymond was one of the only guys that got suspended for what he did to Domantas Sabonis after we went through and litigated all the different things that people could have got suspended for. So if it's Draymond, yeah, it's a fucking, probably a suspension.
Right.
Patrick Beverly, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I want to make it a race thing.
I'm not saying it's a race thing. I don't want to say that.
No. I'm not saying that you were, but I don't think it is race dependent. I think it is player personnel dependent, right? So, you know, if it was Grayson Allen, for instance, there's another white guy that we constantly bring up in these scenarios, maybe he gets suspended too, right? Because he's had these moments where he's tripped folks and, you know, had some really hard fouls that resulted in some serious injuries for players. But, you know, I don't think, regardless of who it was, if it was Jokic or Jamal Murray or like anybody in the NBA, that to me is not suspended. It should not have been a suspension for anybody. Although it's possible that the NBA would have taken a different look at it if it was Draymond Green.
Yeah. They might have. They definitely might have. And 25K, yeah. Like, come on, bro. These are drops in the bucket for the guy. Like,
yeah, that's like less than 1% of his salary, I think, for this year. So that's not an issue.
I also want to say something really quick. Like, I just love Mike Malone. I really do. We follow every single NBA team, and I love watching their post game stuff. Yeah. Not just the interviews. I love what they do in the locker room and how they give away the belts and the chains and stuff like that. And Mike Malone, like, even said in the press conference, like, I don't give a shit who it is. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't even think he knew that was the owner. Not too many people know who Matt Ishbia is. They will sooner or later. Like, they will.
They do now.
They definitely do now. Yeah. They definitely do now. I love the post the press conferences. I love Mike Malone. Let's get into your boys, Drew. It's time. You have a very, very big game tonight in any one of these series. Once you get to game four, you know, it's basically all about, like, we've seen each other three times. We know what we're all capable of doing. We can sit here and talk about how important Anthony Davis is till we get blue in the face, because everybody's saying the same thing, because that's what it comes down to. What mm-hmm. Anthony Davis are the Lakers going to have defensively, offensively? But look, it comes down to who just wants this more. That's what it is. We've seen each other three times. We kind of know what's going to be thrown at us. We had mentioned before the series started about how the others were going to be big. The others have been very big for the Lakers. The D'Lo buckets have been great. You got defense from Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt hit a couple big shots too. But at the end of the day, it comes down to Anthony Davis. And you had mentioned before we started this show, man, and you're wearing your Lakers shirt right now. You think you got all the momentum? Lakers are going to bring this shit home, and you're going to make it to the Western Conference Finals. How are you feeling right now?
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. I'm wearing not only the Lakers shirt, I'm wearing the Lakers bubble shirt, folks.
You are,
because
shout out to the Hoopery.
We're bringing another Western Conference Finals appearance to LA once more. We're going to be playing whoever the fuck gets out of that Suns and Nuggets series, and. You know, as much confidence as I have, it really just it stems back from game one, which is truthfully the only game that has taken place. Like, game two and three was decided in the second quarter from both teams. Lakers, I mean, shit, dude, we might as well have just given them game two and just flew home an extra day early and just say we forfeit game two, because that was a fucking atrocity. And I think likewise, game three was very similar for the Warriors, right? Like, the Warriors were just not there. It seemed like in game three, at least, you know, after the first quarters and all these games have been pretty tight, but second quarters have decided the winners of games two and games three. I don't expect that to be the case tonight. The Warriors back against the wall here. They know they can't go down 3-1. They really need to bring 2-2 back home for a very pivotal game five, and it'll be an uphill fucking battle. But guess what, Clips? Lakers in six, my prediction is still very much intact.
It is
Lakers and sticks. It's actually working perfectly for how I outlined this thing to go here. I think the Lakers will take this game four. I expect it to be more competitive than the last two were. And we're going to go up to Golden State and probably lose game five. So it'll be 3-2, and then we'll come home and win game six. That's how it's going to go. If I can predict one thing thus far, it's been how the Lakers are going to play. And I have a pretty solid understanding of this team and this roster. And I think we are bringing some different shit to the Warriors that they weren't ready for. I want to talk about Jared Vanderbilt in game one. And I want to talk about how the Warriors have adjusted, and Steph Curry in particular has adjusted. We are making Steph Curry a point guard in this series, and I love it. And it's all about Jared Vanderbilt. I did not expect him to be as impactful as he was in game one. He was all over the goddamn place. In the podcast that we did just before that game, I didn't think we were going to have an answer for Steph, but Jared is 6'8". He's got like a 7-foot wingspan or something like that. And you couldn't be built more for the game of basketball. If you just looked at his body type and what he brings to the table athletically, I think his defensive awareness is off the charts. I also think his understanding of how Steph moves and he stays on the ground a lot. Like, he doesn't get caught up in these little things that Steph can do to all these other guys. And then we have the rim protection from Anthony Davis, which, you know, yes, Anthony Davis obviously determines how well we are playing as a team. As you mentioned, that's the most obvious statement that anyone can make when watching the Lakers play is, oh, Anthony Davis had 11-7. I guess the Lakers probably didn't win that game. Yeah, probably didn't win that game, right? Correct. You're right. And so, look, I think the adjustments coming off of game one that Steve Kerr implemented in game two, that Steph Curry implemented in game two, as being more of a facilitator, understanding that they're going to bring a lot of that pressure, and trying to get Klay Thompson just going. Klay had an awesome game two, 30 points, and has been dominating Austin Reeves. I'm nervous about that matchup. Wouldn't mind seeing Beasley or, you know, one of these other guys come in and offer a little bit more defensive, you know, pressure when Klay is feeling like, if Klay has a great first quarter, you know, he had 18 points in like that first half of game one. And I thought Austin Reeves did okay, but in game two specifically, Austin was way off the pace defensively. He's been in a bit of a slump. Just generally, his game has not been as sharp as it was in the first series against the Grizzlies.
Since he said he was him, since sure. That game one.
Yeah, I don't think him means in posterity. I think him meant in the moment, and I'm going to stick by that. Austin can use a breather right now. Let's be real. He's played in way more minutes and way more games than he's ever had to play in his entire life. College basketball only lasts maybe 38 games. And in this season, he's been in every single game. And provided serious minutes. And I do think he might just be dealing with a little bit of fatigue. He's also got to be feeling a little banged up. That guy hits the ground a lot. you know, sometimes, if, you know, through the force of the play, sometimes through his own flopping abilities. But I wouldn't mind seeing us switch up the looks on Klay Thompson specifically if he's feeling it in this game four, right? If we can still apply the pressure to Steph and force him into difficult looks as possible, and with having Jared Vanderbilt all over him, then I think it is going to be the others. It's going to be the Jordan Poole, Klay Thompson.
Can we talk about Jordan Poole?
Let's see if Wiggins can actually shoot himself out of what he's been doing. I've been waiting for Wiggins to really drop a game. He hasn't had one of those type of like performances from last season where he was getting like 22 and 12 kind of games. He still hasn't had one of those. But the biggest thing before we talk about Poole was Looney. Looney has another 20 rebound game one, does a pretty good job, then has an illness and goes to the bench, and they're bringing Jermichael Green. Really interesting decision from Steve Kerr. But what it did do in that game too is it allowed Draymond to make Anthony Davis very uncomfortable. He was all over him. He was making AD work for all of his stuff. I think the Warriors need to do more Anthony Davis Draymond matchups. And who knows, maybe Kevon Looney's inserted back into the lineup after that abysmal game three. But the idea that they lost Looney and still won game two, for instance, was pretty shocking. Again, the Lakers' efforts were lacking in game two. The Warriors' efforts were lacking in game three. So it's hard to really put a finger on the pulse of this series. I think game four will be much more like game one. I'm excited to see it, and I hope for a not blowout, but I hope for a Lakers win. But that was the thing that shocked me potentially the most in the series is how well Draymond did against Anthony Davis in that game two, and how little the Warriors seem to miss Looney out there in game two. I think he'll probably be back on the court starting again in game four. We'll see what that looks like.
Yeah, I think he has to, because Jermichael like shot horribly in that game three in the beginning. He got a lot of good looks. I like Jermichael Green.
He's going to get a lot of good looks. If he's hitting a couple of those, it's a much different offensive unit for the Warriors for sure.
I agree. And like, you know, you specifically talk about LeBron, you know, taking plays off, taking quarters off some time to save his energy for the fourth quarter. And, you know, LeBron seems to really know when to do it and when not to do it. And he did that in the first, didn't take a shot in the first quarter, kind of just facilitated the whole, basically facilitated that whole first quarter, that whole game, getting other people going, went to D'Lo when D'Lo was hitting. It's funny how how is D'Angelo Russell going to be like a huge part of this series, right? Because we both kind of don't have too much faith in him, but when he's on, he's on, right? And I also thought in the beginning of that game where he hit, I think he hit his first three, I'm like, oh, this is great for the Warriors because D'Lo's going to keep jacking these up. And he did. He did. I think he missed like his next four and whatnot. But LeBron, knowing when to turn it on, he specifically didn't take a shot in the first quarter. It's not that he didn't get any looks and didn't have any shots, but he went into that game saying, you know what, I'm going to get everybody else loose. And it worked out in your favor. I'm concerned for the Warriors with the Jordan Poole thing. And you brought up Andrew Wiggins, him being such a huge part of last year's championship run, last year's playoff run. They definitely need more from Wiggins, but Poole is just shaky to me. And I had a lot of Poole stock last year, a lot. The shot selection that he takes is questionable. It's not just that final shot that he took in game one. Most of his shots are questionable. They look like very difficult, right? Am I right, though? Like, you remember how we were just saying how Devin Booker seems to not never be rushed, and he's very calm, and like he doesn't really take a bad shot. It seems like every shot Jordan Poole takes is a very rushed bad shot, and sometimes they go in. It's true. This happens. Yeah. Some people are very comfortable. Jamal Crawford was very comfortable coming off the dribble, and what seems to be difficult shots are very comfortable for those players, but I don't think it's comfortable for Jordan Poole. What do you think about it?
Look, he was instrumental in game one, giving the Warriors as much life as possible. So look, people can go back and forth on whether or not he takes that 28 footer or not. The 28 footer at the end of game one is not the problem. It's the rest of the shots, like you're talking about. And look, if there's a guy on the court who can hit that 28 footer other than Steph, it's Jordan Poole.
True.
It is. I mean, nobody on the Lakers can hit that shot, even with LeBron doing his infamous stare at the ball before I shoot it move. Nobody on the Lakers team has that kind of range. And he very easily could have made that shot, and then we're all talking a whole nother game. But I think the bigger picture is what you're saying. Jordan seems to make it harder on himself. Like, he'll take an easy layup and he'll make it a reverse layup for no reason, right? He can drive the lane and just do a quick little pop bank shot from 10 to 12 feet or a little floater. He never seems to rely on that anymore because he just wants to go, he's going too fast. And then, a lot of his pull up game is just really hard shots. But that's just him. I mean, like, look, this is not out of character for him, right? Even in the year that Steph was out and he was really blossoming and had that great season, he was just making really difficult shots. Like, this is just kind of this whole game. I even remember back when he was in Michigan, the game winner that he had, what is probably the second round, he hit almost that exact shot that he missed in game one against the Lakers. He hit that for Michigan as a buzzer beater just on the other side of the floor to win the fucking game and advance them into the next round. So this is just part of his MO. And I also think, like, when we talk about Jordan Poole's development, it is, at least to me, it's so closely linked to Steph Curry. So when he watches Steph Curry and he implements Steph Curry, it's not a shocker to see him take bad shots because
but he's not Steph Curry.
He's not correct. You're correct. Absolutely right. And I'm never going to say that he is Steph Curry. But when you watch his game and you've seen his development, you go, okay, I understand why he thinks he can take that shot, because he has Steph Curry on his team making those shots all the time. And Steph makes the impossible seem possible. I mean, look at AAU. Anytime you're if you want to watch the craziest thing you've ever seen, go watch a 12 and under AAU game. And tell me how many step back threes these 12-year-olds are taking in an AAU game where they can barely hit the damn rim, right? So this is it's a part of why Steph has such an impact on the culture and the game of basketball. You can just look at his teammate Jordan Poole and go, Steph doing what he does has given Jordan the confidence to think that he can do the same. And sometimes he can.
I just think he's more valuable. Look, these minutes that he gets right now are so important for the Warriors. They do need the buckets, you know, and I just think if he can, he's very good off the dribble. His handle is tight. It's nice.
He's lightning fast.
It is. He can get to the rim easily. I just think he's making it more difficult for himself. You just got to go to your bread and butter. I have so much Jordan Poole stock, and I mentioned that I really thought that Kuminga was going to get some time. Look, Moody's got some good minutes recently, who has been nice, but they're just not letting Kuminga do it. Maybe we'll see Kuminga tonight. Look, after getting blown out by 30, you need to try something new, especially coming off the bench. You got to try some new shit. And I could be completely wrong, but I think tonight's the night that Kuminga will actually get a little bit of burn, not trash minutes. Maybe put him on Braun, put him on AD, put him on somebody, let him touch somebody. I've been saying that a lot lately because it seems like he wants to be that kind of guy. I'm going to go a different route than you, though, Drew. I believe in this Warriors team with their pedigree and everything. I understand they're coming off a huge loss. I think they're going to steal one in LA tonight. And I'm also saying that because a couple of our listeners had begged that you guys, please do not jinx the Lakers. Don't jinx them tonight. Don't talk about them. It is what it is. I think this is a shout out to our boy Breezy Fresh. because he said, man, please, please do not jinx the boys. I think the Warriors are going to win tonight. I think they're going to go up, up back to the Bay 2-2. I think we're due for a Steph Curry blowout game, a big game from him. I think if anybody can adjust, Steve Kerr is really good at this stuff. You know what I mean? And it's like I said in the beginning of this whole segment, obviously it's going to come down to Anthony Davis. I think tonight there's going to be some wild foul calls where I think that Anthony Davis is going to get in foul trouble early. I think he's going to get too quick, and I think they're going to have to go to the bench early. If anybody can figure out, as much as Vanderbilt's been great guarding Steph, it takes me back. I know I brought this up before, but I remember in that the Clippers Oklahoma City series in 13, I just remember when OKC put Thabo Sefolosha on Chris Paul, and it was really difficult for Chris Paul to do anything because of the length and all of that. And I think he has been a nuisance for Steph, right? But if anybody can adjust to it, I think it's going to be Steph. And yeah, I think that's what it's going to be. I think Golden State wins tonight. I think it's going to be a close one. But look, man, I got to give props to the Lakers just right now where they're at with this. If they can pull this one out and go 3-1 into the Bay and be in the Western Conference Finals and close this out, this has to go down. This has to be talked about Darvin Ham. This has to go down with Rob Pelinka making these trades, adjustments mid-season to put together a legit basketball team. It's a testament to LeBron too, like, to be able to do this again. But I think with this series in particular, we can't jump to like, oh, Lakers are in the Western Conference Finals. Gotta win these games, man. And again, the sentiment can be completely different tomorrow if they're going 2-2 back to the Bay, like, mm-hmm. It's a different conversation. So I just want to be devil's advocate and say that the Lakers are going to lose tonight, even though the momentum is definitely – look, when you blow out the defending champs by 30, it's a good look in the locker room. You know what I mean? It's a really good look. But I also think that if anybody doesn't like getting blown out by 30, it's the three people on Golden State. It's Draymond, it's Klay, and it's Steph. But they're definitely going to need a lot more for Anthony Davis. And if history repeats itself again, if we're going every other game for Anthony Davis, this is going to be a bad game for Anthony, right?
Yeah, he hasn't had back-to-back 20-point games this offseason, or this postseason. He has yet to do back-to-back.
So they just said Warriors expected to start GP Jr., which is an interesting adjustment, right?
Very interesting. So yeah, because I think they assume that the Lakers will start Vanderbilt. So they don't have to, GP, you put GP on whoever you want. Mm-hmm. You put Draymond on AD. Mm-hmm. And then Steph can guard Vanderbilt on the other end. Steph can relax on the defensive end. He can put Steph on Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt has no post game. All Steph has to do is just watch for backdoor cuts and then try and box out a little bit on offensive rebounds, because Vanderbilt will get the boards. He'll go rebound.
Do you think that's a chess move right there, or no? It's just another, like we just said, it's adjustments that you have to make and try out.
Yeah, and so before I say yes or no, it's instead of Jermichael Green, right? Mm-hmm. He's starting over Jermichael, and that means Looney's also not starting?
I don't know. I don't know what they're going to – Looney should be starting. The Jermichael experiment worked. It worked for one game. It was cool.
Yeah, it was a great switch, yeah. Right. Really good switch up, yeah.
But that cannot be your starting center. It just can't.
yeah. No, I'd love to see what I will have to wait and see what the actual lineup is. But the assumption is it'll be Steph, Klay, Wiggins, Draymond, and GP. I think that's how it goes, because GP that opens up the floor for him to be able to be the slasher and finisher at the rim, on the offensive end, and then apply some really good pressure to D'Lo, right? Because D'Lo has been good in this series. We need his scoring, so maybe they'll try and slow D'Lo down and allow Steph to, like I said, guard Vanderbilt on the other side and not have to do much as far as the minutes that Vanderbilt will be on the court.
You got Lakers winning tonight, going up to the Bay 3-1. I got Golden State winning it tonight, tying it 2-2. I have one final Laker question for you that a lot of people have been talking about, and I've had this discussion with a couple people, but Pat Bev on the podcast, on his podcast last week, was talking about how they want their rings. If Lakers win the chip this year, they want him and Russell want their rings. And
We got 19 rings coming if we win a championship, because all the players that we shed over the course of the year.
That is true. I'm actually all for it, though. I think they deserve it. I think it's part of it. They played. I do. What do you think? I mean, look, you go through training camp, you go through the, I mean, shit, if anybody deserves a ring, it's Russell for what he'd had to go through. Like, just from the media and from all the criticism he got, like, throw this guy a ring. Obviously, it's not going to be, like, counted for in the history books, right? But, like, give these guys the ring. What do you think as a Laker fan?
Well, the rules are the rules, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so many guys have gotten rings that had nothing to do with the success of their team. They were traded mm-hmm. away midseason. It shouldn't stop now just because, you know, these guys weren't a part of the success that we've had for this year. So, you know, from a rules standpoint, I understand it. And sure, Pat and Russ and, whoever the hell else we gave up over the course of the year,
Kendrick Nunn.
I don't think he played enough minutes. I don't think he played enough games, actually. None. I don't think he did. But whoever qualifies, that's totally fine. Get the ring. But when your kid asks you when you won that championship ring, mm-hmm. he'll be like, well, technically I was out in the first round, because I was on the Clippers. So I didn't actually win the championship.
Damn, Drew.
But that's the truth of the matter. Clips. Did he win a championship? No, he didn't. Did he get a ring? Yes, he did. I think that's how I would identify with what's taking place there.
If they
want the ring, then go get the ring. And this is, we're talking, you know, a long shot here. The Lakers should not be even money to win the championship by any means. We have a very tough task here with the Warriors. We're going to have another one in the next series if we get out of this series. And then the finals is going to be, you know, whatever, you know, that's going to be its own bundle of fun as well. So I just, that's on Pat and that's on Russ, and they, you know, they just can get the ring, and if it comes to that, they'll have one that they can put on the mantelpiece.
Know for a fact that the night Lakers win the championship, Pat Bev's calling Pelinka and being like, yo, just make sure my ring's in the mail, you know what I mean, because I want
give
that
the size, give the size, the ring size. It'll be interesting too, because typically what happens when you get a ring is you have to come back to the stadium.
Oh yeah, that's right,
the fandom. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing, like, I don't know. Maybe shipping is involved here. Maybe they do get the rings, but they don't get the whole, like, now returning for the Lakers, Russell Westbrook, championship ring. Because zero things were contributed by those two individuals for this championship, other than leaving the organization.
So I'm thinking Laker Nation should just give it to him on game, because it's like, this is a thank you for leaving, because we got all these great pieces.
Thank you for accepting the fact that we traded you for Mo Bamba. Thank you for the fact that we traded you for guys that are actually fitting the system well. And again, the Russell Westbrook thing, we talked ad nauseum about it. Like, I don't want to bring it up again, but I don't really think all of this shit was his fault.
Right.
This was a bad decision from all sides on all parts. They thought that they could make it work for whatever the fucking reason they did was beyond me. I would have talked him out of it for hours. I would have been on all three of them. I'd be like, hold on, let's slow this down, because this is not how this works. But it's not all on Russ. I think he was a valuable member to the Clippers. I think he should be back with the Clippers or whoever the hell ends up wanting him. I think he still has enough in the tank to be a good player for other teams that don't have LeBron James and Anthony Davis on him. And it looks nice on paper, looks nice on billboards. But Russ, you know, you're going to have to answer the questions for the people that go, where did that ring come from? Not me.
Actually, I think Patrick would be happy to take the ring, and I think Russell would take the ring and do something like really dramatic with it, like sell it or set it on fire or something. Because if anything, from everything I gather from Russell is that he definitely did not enjoy his time with the Lakers, so he probably doesn't want to remember that season. Anyway,
didn't enjoy it either.
No, I agree. I enjoyed my time with Russell this year, minus the first round exit. Give me a final thought, Drew. We got a game to watch here.
My final thought. I'm growing a playoff beard, Clips. I haven't shaved since before the regular season, before my trip to Japan. And for those people that do watch us on IG when we put out our clips, you'll notice it's getting pretty luscious right now. It's getting pretty thick. A little chin music going on here and there. I'm gonna have to keep it maintained here. But I'm growing a playoff beard. I am in solidarity with this Lakers organization, with this team, inch for inch, beard hair for beard hair. And so I'm growing a playoff beard, and I will not shave it, Clips, until the Lakers are out of the playoffs. So my wife now will probably be rooting for the Warriors, I'll be honest with you. That's number one. Number two, this is my actual final thought, is what sport, Clips, do you think benefits the most from drone coverage? What sport do you think benefits the most from a drone that you fly around that has a camera on it? What sport do you think?
Track and field. Soccer would be cool.
Maybe surfing.
Surfing is surfing, motocross. Yeah.
You know what sport doesn't benefit from it?
NBA basketball.
NBA fucking basketball does not benefit from a drone coverage. There is like 70 cameras in each NBA arena, especially for the playoffs. We do not need a drone flying in and out of our view on the television, or flying in and out of the fans' view that paid good money to be in those seats, only for a drone to be like covering the fucking hoop. TNT, please stop using drone footage in these games. It is completely unnecessary, and I just don't understand. It is an indoor sport. You do not need another camera. We had cameras on wires. Now we got cameras on fucking flying around the stadium. I can only imagine what's going to happen when that battery dies and it falls down out of the stands and smashes somebody on the head.
That's
and
Marcus Smart's hair.
For $200 million because the drone dropped something, or a camera, or a piece, thing, or something flew off and hit somebody in the eye. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. That's my final thought. Get the fuck out of here, drones. Go cover sports that need drone footage.
I appreciate that final thought, Drew. I think you are spot on. Let's give props for at least like trying it out. They're trying something new. If anything, if the NBA does anything, bring back like that All-Star game view where they had on the floor
cam.
Yeah.
The floor cam.
Bring that.
Brought that. They had that in the bubble too. I don't think they can do it in stadiums because of fans.
Yeah. The fans are too close anyways.
It's the front row of the fans. So they have to move that whole front row back. They're not doing that. They're not going to do that in these arenas when fans are there, because they want people to be on the court. They want people to pay, you know, the thousands of dollars for them to be able to sit court side. They want that revenue. So they're not going to push fans back and bring back the floor cam. Although I agree with you, that was a really cool perspective that we got to see in the bubble and in those All-Star games.
Definitely don't need the drone. And those floor seats for that Laker game tonight is $31,900. I mean, that's a lot. Your feet want to be on the floor. No, that's humongous. And, you know, when AI takes over the world, which was going to be my final thought last week until it went right to Dylan Brooks and I got cut off from that. But when AI takes over, and then the drones are just going to go out and attack the players. That's just what's going to happen.
We're going to have drone 5-on-5. We'll just have drones playing basketball against each other. And then we can then drone footage will be necessary.
Hey, my final thoughts, a quick one. I had a cool moment this week. You know, my restaurant that I've been at forever, which is part of my life. I love my place. It's directly next to my house. It's just a big part of my life. Anyways, we always have famous people coming through because, you know, San Clemente is a beautiful town, and my restaurant is the best restaurant in town. If you want to come and have brunch and drink mimosas, it just is what it is. We've had, you know, James Harden, Andre Iguodala. We've had Jimmy Buckets has been through there. It's just really cool. And you never know who you're going to run into. And so it was funny because I was working the other day, and immediately when this person walked in, I'm like, I know you. And I'm like, Bobby? It was Bobby frickin' Hurley, right? Who probably doesn't get noticed a lot. You know, he's a grown, he's 40, whatever. He's probably 47 right now. I knew it right away. Bobby frickin' Hurley. He's like, yeah, man. He was with his wife. And I was so stoked because this is my childhood. I mean, Bobby Hurley, that's who us short white guys looked up to, right? Like, if Bobby Hurley could do it, we all could do it. And anyways, I didn't talk his ear off, but I sat them at a really nice table. I told him, I'm like, hey man, my name's Clips. I'm the basketball guy in town. Stoked to meet you. Introduced me to his wife. He's so nice. And as much as I wanted to pick his brain, and I let him know about our podcast and whatnot, but I got to respect Bobby Hurley because it's 9 o'clock in the morning. And when I offer, you know, you guys want something to drink? He's like, Stella. I'm like, I already like you. Right. So
Vacation mode.
He's engaged. Not vacation. He lives here now. So he, but during the pandemic, They bought a home in Capo. So he lives in Capo Beach, and then he's the head coach of Arizona State. So he coaches at Arizona State, and which we've been invited. He's like, I got to get you guys out for a game. I said, you know, my co-host is a Wildcat and knows Arizona very well. So we will be going to an Arizona State game. Anyways, it was just really cool. The difference being is that it's crazy how now we're just two old guys now drinking beers, talking basketball, you know, and as much as you want to dive into the Duke days and the national championships. And yeah, he didn't know that. Like I could name everybody on his Sacramento Kings team in 1994. I'm like, shit, you played with Dwayne Coswell and Brian Grant had short hair then. And like Walt Williams was there, Mitch Richmond was there. And like, he was kind of shocked at that whole thing, but he's definitely going to come back. He's definitely going to, I told him, I said, I want to spend like an hour with you, at least picking your brain, have a beer, talk. What a great guy to talk to though. Right. And so in retirement, he's big into horses. Like I don't know if he bets on horses or they own horses. I didn't get into all that. And we have a bar in town, the OC Tavern, where you can bet on horses and whatnot. So he's been spending a lot of time over there. And his wife is like, we're done with OC Tavern. We need to come over to this side of the town. And it was just really awesome. So I don't know how many people in San Clemente recognize Bobby Hurley right off the jump. But
he's also a shorter guy too. Like you said, he's a shorter guy, so he doesn't stick out like a tall guy would, like a 6'8" player would, you know, like Jimmy or Iggy.
Yeah, you know Jimmy Buckets when he walks in, you know,
and they stand out. Like you can pick him out just walking on the side of the street. You go, that's a big dude, whoever that is. I don't know who that is, but that's a big guy right there. Oh shit, that's Jimmy Butler, or oh shit, that's Rex Chapman. You know what I mean? Like Bobby can fly right under the radar here. It probably looks like a surfer more than anything else now.
No, he looks like just an older guy, like an older hoop head. Like that's just what he is. And
no, what I'm saying is like he looks just like your average 50-year-old surfer in San Clemente. He's probably pretty tan. He's probably what, like 6 foot.
So yeah, he's my height.
He probably fits in great with the rest of the crowd. That's awesome though.
Oh, he could sit at OC Tavern and watch the horse races, and I guarantee you, not one person went up to him and been like, "Damn, you're a 3-time national champion, right?"
I bet there's a couple people that OC Tavern that might have said what up to him and been like, "Congrats on, you know, your brother who won a national championship for crying out loud!"
Right.
That's the one thing that his little brother's got on him. I think actually, in all of it, is the championship that he won with Connecticut this year. So yeah, big stuff for the Hurley family. That's what's up. I would have loved to ask him what his thoughts were on the Draymond stomping on Sabonis, because he was there for the Leitner stomp.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to see what his response to that would have been.
Well, I didn't want, again, like I know his wife was super nice and they were very, I didn't bombard them at all. I mean, I sat down with them and talked to them and I drank a mimosa with them. But I wasn't going to pick his brain about basketball while they're like in San Clemente. But we did talk. I'm like, man, what do you think about that Kings run? And he definitely, because you know he played for the Kings and when they were really, really bad. And we talked about that. We talked about, I had mentioned to him about how you were just so hyped on Arizona winning a national championship. Oh, and then the following week, it's just a wrap. And he actually found that kind of because you know I'm it's sure Arizona. So anyways, we're gonna get out to a game. Bobby Hurley will definitely be on the show at some point and we can ask him all those questions. So it was just really cool, and I think he was a little taken back because of all the basketball that I know, and I was ready to talk. If it was just Bobby Hurley, he would have had to literally like beat me off of him from talking to him. There was a lot.
I also think it's funny too, because it's 9 o'clock in the morning. He's like probably just woken up not too long ago, getting there, and you've been up for like 5 hours.
Yeah.
And this is prime time of the day for you.
So oh, as soon as I go, Drew, as soon as I saw him, I'm like, oh my God, what's up, Bobby? I'm Clips. I'm the basketball guy in town. I have an NBA podcast. And he's like, this is my wife.
Like, he's like, hold on. I need a Stella right now because I need a moment before we start doing any of this stuff. And give me some breakfast too. Throw a plate of food at me.
Well, I definitely took care of his drink. So he was great. He tipped very well. And I'm looking forward to seeing him again. So anyways, we got Knicks. We got Heat. We got Lakers. We got Golden State. It's a big night tonight. We're going to be back in a couple days. It's the Follow Through with Clips and Drew. And we're ghosts.
This is the Follow Through. Clips and Drew.